This is Barron's Live. Each weekday, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Hello, and welcome to Tech Trader on Barron's Live. This is the first in a monthly series of live conversations with important players in the technology investing world. I'm Barron's Associate Editor, Eric Sabatz. As my first guest, I'm happy to welcome Katie Huberty, who's the Managing Director and Head of Tech Research at Morgan Stanley and one of Wall Street's most influential voices on computer hardware stocks. Katie's been with Morgan Stanley for more than 20 years, joining the firm in 2000, right in the middle of the internet bubble. Good timing, Katie. After graduating from the University of Wisconsin's Business School, Barron's recently included Katie on the latest edition of our list of the 100 most influential women in U.S. finance. Katie, welcome to Barron's Live, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. So excited to be here. Good day, everyone. Looking forward to the discussion.
Thank you. So, Katie, I want to start with a call that you made last October in the middle of what was a huge run-up in technology prices, particularly software stocks. You turned bullish on hardware. Now, at the time, hardware stocks, other than Apple, had been lagging pretty badly behind not just software stocks, but also the broad market. And this year, that has turned out to be a far-sighted a call, and hardware has done very well year to date. Most of the stocks that you follow are up double digits, other than Apple. So we'll come back to Apple in a minute, but give us a little bit of sense of what you were thinking when you made that call last fall.
Sure. So this is a great example of benefiting from 20 plus years of looking at an industry, right? I lived through the internet bubble bursting. We lived through the impact on CapEx spend after 9/11, after the global financial crisis. And so we're actually quite early in cutting numbers back in March when the pandemic hit. But we also have a pretty intense database of data points that we track very closely and had experienced how robust the CapEx recovery is after a big external factor like what we've seen from the pandemic over the last year. And so a lot of that call was driven by recognition of cycles, and as well as a really big repository of data that had bottomed over the summer. And, you know, both those data sets and some of our qualitative conversations with VARs, think about them as the middlemen between the customer and the technology companies, telling us that the rate of change, the rate of decline in CapEx spending was starting to improve. And when you look at a sector like hardware, which is highly cyclical, it tends to lead performance, not just across the whole tech sector during an economic recovery, but also significantly outperforms the S&P 500. The other dynamic, which was important to our call, was that you get significant performance breadth during a CapEx recovery, with about 90% of our coverage outperforming the market in the 12 to 18 months that we see recovering demand. And that's exactly what's played out. I think last time we looked, about 83% of our stocks have outperformed the market, most of them significantly, on average about 40 points of outperformance since we upgraded back in October.
So one thing that clearly happened last year was a pickup in demand for personal computers. And it's not surprising. We have many people who are working from home, learning from home, doing meetings from home, holding online video interviews from home. So lots of things are happening that have driven that demand. And that's helped not just Apple shares last year, but also Dell and HP.
Right.
How are you feeling about PC demand from here as we reopen?
I'm not a believer in the COVID bump in this case. I think this is a COVID reset higher in demand. Just to give you a couple of metrics, in the US, the average household only owns 1.2 PCs. So you think about, one or two people working from home, one or two kids learning from home. 1.2 PCs isn't going to cut it. And then you look at emerging markets like even China, which is obviously much more developed than some of the others, only 12% of K-12 students have access to a PC at home. Because in China, the market really skipped the PC and went straight to smartphones. And now with the need to be able to work and learn from home, that's changing. They're having to go back and reinvest in PCs. So we think that is a big structural change driven by COVID. But then there's other dynamics, like more people are buying notebooks. Notebooks get replaced more often. So that alone is going to drive higher PC unit shipments structurally going forward. And I get a lot of questions around, you know, what happens when we all go back to work? And, you know, no longer do you have to buy the incremental PC to support another person working or learning from home. And there must be this big drop off in demand. But we actually think commercial demand is going to pick up as consumer demand perhaps slows. Most companies have not refreshed their PCs in the last year since work from home began. And what we're hearing from CIOs is they're thinking about the PC as an employee satisfaction driver, which I think about it almost as how we're going to get people back into the office. We're going to make sure they have an advanced, updated workstation. They're going to have all the peripherals that they need to, you know, still work in a hybrid work environment. And I think we'll still be on, you know, Zooms or other video platforms in the foreseeable future, whether that be from work or home. But I think there's more investment to come in the commercial and corporate space, even if we do see some slowing of consumer and education demand going into the back half of this year.
So let's talk about a couple of the players. We're going to get to Apple in a minute, but first I want to touch on HP and Dell. Both of those companies have had, both stocks have done very well recently, but for reasons that are very different.
Right.
Let's start with HP, which has had a really nice move, certainly since your call in the fall. But there's a couple of other things going on here besides just HP, besides just PC demand growth. Tell us how you feel about HP.
So HP is unique in the sense that they benefit if the pandemic impacts last longer, and they benefit if reopening happens sooner. And so you're diversifying, you know, the macro outcomes to some extent. As I just walked through, right now consumer education PC demand is strong, but when reopening happens, you'll get the commercial corporate demand. But on the printer space, what's interesting is the company is vertically integrated in inkjet printers, meaning they own all the intellectual property, and their margins are higher. And what has happened is that both cyclically and we think long term, there is going to be more printing at home and less printing in the office. And that creates a larger profit pool for HP. In fact, you know, if you know, printed pages, let's just pick numbers, are down 10% in the office, you actually don't need 10% growth in home printing pages to offset it, because the profitability is much better. So COVID is a structural benefit to PCs. It's a structural benefit specifically to HP in printing because of this dynamic where their margins are higher in the home segment. And then you have a company that over the next 2 years, we'll buy back over 20% of the company through share repurchases. And so they're creating value for shareholders that way. So, you know, it's a really nice diverse bet, regardless of what your view is around the pandemic.
Yeah, so I just do want to touch one more second on the buyback situation, right? If you go back a year ago, there was a lot of discussion about Xerox trying to buy HP. HP said that, of course, they rejected the offer and said that what they would do is aggressively repurchase shares.
Right.
And after a bit of a pause during the pandemic, they have jumped in aggressively, and they are buying back how much per quarter?
So the last couple of quarters, they've bought back $1.4 billion each quarter. And, you know, I imagine that pace, that what they've committed to is at least $1 billion each quarter. Right. So that probably means you'll be between $1 billion and $1.5 billion per quarter for the foreseeable future. It is a little bit less than they had actually committed to. I think they talked about 8 billion in the 12 months. But then right. COVID hit, right? That was in February of 2020. So they've been very smart around adjusting for the environment. One of the other things they did in February 20 is they outlined the synergies around Xerox. You know, they communicated to the market that that combination may make sense and there would be synergies, right? But they also communicated that they weren't willing to do that deal unless they had the opportunity to conduct more diligence and that they could get it at the right price. And what you've seen recently is they've shifted focus away from consolidating office print because they're unsure of what the long-term demand outlook looks like, and instead have been making investments in the peripheral space. So this goes back to, you know, companies and consumers investing in all the peripherals that allow them to get more value out of the PCs on their desk.
Right, and there've been great performance by companies in the peripheral business, right? Mm-hmm. Logitech had fantastic yeah. earnings the last couple yeah. of years, for example.
And so, HP doesn't really see the peripherals business slowing down, and so that's why they're choosing to invest in that space rather than chasing office print consolidation.
And they, of course, just announced recently an acquisition in that space.
HyperX, yes, right. which is yeah. a little bit more focused on gaming, but I think there's more, even more that they may do in the peripheral space.
Right. So I want to touch on Dell for a moment. Dell is kind of a special situation, really. And it's tied to the fact that they're the largest shareholder in VMware. And they have said that they might spin off VMware later this year. What right. do you expect to happen? And how do you think about Dell shares?
So simplistically, what's happening, and this was true when EMC was standalone and owned VMware, but the market essentially applies a 30% consolidation discount on the ownership of that business, even though we have full transparency into the valuation, right? It's a stock right. that trades, we know the market cap, but shareholders, when it's consolidated with another company, applies about a 30% discount. So the opportunity is if you separate VMware, make it a fully independent company, then that consolidation discount should go away. Now, there's also a discount to Dell for significant debt levels, which they have been very smart about and aggressive in paying down. But one of the messages that they've sent to the market is if this spin of VMware happens, there will likely be a dividend paid from VMware to shareholders, you know, of which Dell owns 80% plus. So most right. of that dividend would go to Dell as a company, and they would use that cash to pay down debt and get into a leverage range that is much more in line with peers. And that 10% or so discount that's applied to core Dell valuation because of high leverage would also go away. So we think that in a full spin scenario, our bull case is $133 stock.
And where's the stock now?
You know, the stock is, you know, is approaching 90.
Last one.
And so, you know, look, I mean, we've come from 50 last summer, right? So it's been a phenomenal performer, but we still see upside if the spin happens. Now, there's certainly some risk. Dell's board is negotiating with VMware's board on what the commercial agreement would look like between the two companies, what that dividend, the size of that dividend will be. I'm right. sure there's some discussion around the timing of when this happens as right. VMware searches for a new CEO. But there's another element to the Dell story, which is that they very clearly, probably more so than any company I follow, communicated that all of the costs they need to support growth. So one example would be they'd like to take market share in mid-range storage now that they have launched their PowerStore line, and they're investing in sales force to do that. All of the costs are in the model, but they're actually not reflecting a significant revenue recovery in the server and storage business. Right. And we think that will happen in the back half. So if it does, there's a lot of that revenue that will drop to the bottom line because you don't need incremental OpEx to support that right. revenue.
Okay, so I want to, one more question I want to get to before we get to Apple. By the way, we're getting lots of questions in the chat. Keep them coming. I'm not going to get to all of them, but we'll do as many as we can. So one question that's come up from some readers and that I was curious about too is, what is the impact on your universe of the semiconductor shortage that we're seeing?
Yeah.
How much impact are you seeing that on capacity? Are they capacity constrained? Could HP and Dell, for example, sell more PCs if they could only get more parts?
Yeah. Look, the last couple of quarters, the constraint has not been demand. The constraint has been supply. I wouldn't say the companies have specifically quantified, but you're probably in the range of, the numbers could have been, 10, 20% higher in the case of at least areas like Chromebook shipments, where we're hearing there's significant backlog in education, not just in the US, but in other markets. I gave that data point about China. If you have a country where only 12% of students have access to a PC at home, how do you do remote learning? And right. So I think there's significant constraints, at least in pockets of the market, not desktops, but notebooks and Chromebooks. And that's been pretty significant.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about Apple. So Apple had an unbelievable year last year, right? Stock was up 81%. They announced iPhone 12, which we were all anticipating, and it's been a big hit. And the stock is kind of going nowhere this year. It's down about 5% year to date. What's gone wrong with Apple as a stock since really last July, say? And how are you feeling about the stock from here?
Yeah, I mean, it was really September because there was actually a big re-rating.
Oh, you're right.
Last year, but same difference, right? So since September last year, a lot of it has been this concern around interest rates rising, right? And a rotation out of quality. I mean, we talked about the significant outperformance of my stocks already, and we think that continues. That money has to come from somewhere. It's come from the higher growth stocks that experienced multiple expansion in 2019 and 2020. So that's a big part of it. In terms of Apple specifically, there's a bit of hedge fund trading dynamic, and that is that everyone's conditioned to believe that you want to sell on a product cycle, right? You want to sell on the strong results from the first quarter on a product cycle, because after strong growth comes revenue declines, which was true after the iPhone 6 and the iPhone 10. But there's something is different this time around. Well, two things are different. One is that iPhone replacement rates, so basically the average time that people use their iPhone, stretched from 2.5 years to over 4 years. If not for that, Apple's revenue would have grown at twice the pace over the last 5 years. So like 14% growth instead of 7% growth. That's how significant it was. And so when you had a big iPhone cycle, difficult comps, and a replacement cycle that was stretching out, growth did decline for iPhone as well as the overall business. That we don't think is a headwind anymore. In fact, we exited 2020 at 4.2-year replacement cycle. That's almost a year longer than notebooks. It makes no sense, right?
People are actually keeping their phones longer.
Part of it is, so part of it was the carrier stopped subsidizing. Part of it is the category matured a bit. So the pace of innovation wasn't as significant as in the early days. But then last year, there was another stretching of the replacement cycle because people like to go to a store and get help upgrading their phone, making sure it works before they leave the store, making sure that their apps and their data were transferred over. And so with the stores shut down for a good chunk of at least the second half of Apple's last fiscal year, that really served to stretch replacement cycles further. And so that actually reverses and we think becomes a bit of a tailwind here, such that iPhone can not grow at the same pace it is now, but can grow a little bit next year. So that's one thing. The other is the company just isn't as dependent on iPhone as it used to be, right? We just talked about how strong the compute market is. Mac and iPad is benefiting from that. services and wearables is now significant enough, and you know, both categories that are structurally growing double digits and contributing to the top line. And so we think Apple grows, you know, mid to high single digits top line next year. And I think the buy side, at least the hedge fund view, is that there's a risk that revenue declines. And so to me, that's the disconnect. But you know, a lot of the selling has been hedge funds saying, I've seen this cycle before. I want to sell at the peak of the iPhone cycle, because what comes next is, you know, pressure, fundamental pressure and revenue declines. And that's not a view that I share.
So this morning, just this morning, breaking news, you raised your expectations for Apple's services business for the September 21 fiscal year and for fiscal 22. Tell us a little bit about why you did that.
Yeah, so you know, it's always a little confusing when revenue and EPS estimates go up and price target goes.
Yes, that's right. You also reduced your
right. Price. So that created some questions today. But the reality is, what's important is that we think services growth is faster than the market believes, and the simple answer is because Apple collects on search traffic on its platform. You know, the biggest payer is obviously Google, just because they own 80% of that market. And as the ad business recovers, there is going to be more revenue generated from that business. And, you know, we had been mismodeling it. Essentially, that line was a plug because it's a little bit of a black box to investors. You know, we did a lot of work around looking at the correlation of Apple's licensing and other services revenue to the Google TAC, right, traffic acquisition cost, and found that there's a very high correlation. We can use that to forecast the business. And so that's why our services numbers went up, and that's most important from what we published today. The price target adjustment was really just reflecting what I talked about earlier, which is as interest rates went up, peer multiples came down, and our price target is a sum of the parts, looking at internet services peers, where you know, those are growth businesses where the rising interest rates have pulled multiples lower. We wanted to
talking about peers in services per
here. So a Google, an Amazon, a Spotify, and that
right. Okay. Yeah. So I want to ask you for a moment about what has been the buzziest Apple story of 2021, mm-hmm. which is the Apple Car.
Right.
Are you do you think we're going to see an Apple Car? What time frame would you expect? And is it reflected anywhere in your model?
That last question is most important, because if you look at Apple's revenue in any given year, about 10% of it comes from products that didn't exist 5 years before. And you know, we've seen the contribution of iPod and then iPad, or iPhone and then iPad and Watch and AirPods and all the new services.
Right.
And so there's a consistent track record of innovation, and a company that, you know, before iPhone was spending less than $1 billion on R&D, now spends $22 billion a year on R&D. So they're spending enough money, and there's a track record of execution. And so why isn't anybody modeling some sort of innovation or other line and starting to bake that into their outlook on the stock? And I think that's something that should and probably will happen over the next year or two, especially as news flow around augmented reality glasses and car really pick up as new categories that can be contributors. But to answer your question about car, Apple prides itself on what it chooses not to do as much as what it chooses to do, right? And that's different from other technology companies. Not to say it's right or wrong, but it's different, right? You know, they make much more concentrated bets. And so while not all products see the light of day, most, you know, a higher percentage do than at other companies. And so the fact that we're hearing so much about car, and I know, you know, Tim is still being coy about it in his own words, you know, they're still addressing the conversation and acknowledging that autonomous cars are a great example of AI and robotics, and then Apple probably has some technology they can bring to the table. I've always said that Apple's most successful when it's vertically integrated, meaning it controls the hardware, software, and services, mm-hmm. which means there has to be an Apple car. You know, Apple isn't going to develop one element and then sell that technology to car companies. You know, they will build, if they move forward in this category, they will build an Apple-branded car. What timeline that is, I don't think anybody knows. I mean, I'm sure Apple doesn't really know. These things can get pushed out and pulled in, but you know, the press has talked about, you know, sometime over the next 5 years. I think that's reasonable, but you know, I certainly wouldn't want to place my bets on which exact year, which exact quarter it launches at this point.
Right. So if you had to, if you were giving odds on the probability that in 2020, I don't know, six, say, that there'll be an Apple car, what do you think the odds are?
You know, look, I mean, if that they'll have a car at some time in the future, I think it's probably greater than 50%, you know, whether in 2025 or 2026, you know, maybe it's, you know, the timing is a little less than 50%, but I think it's a decent probability at this point that it happens sometime in the future.
So I want to just touch, we have a few minutes left. I want to touch on a couple of other stocks that, that you follow. One that I know that you've been bullish on is Sonos, which has had a fantastic year to date. Yeah. Or, I don't know, 70% year to date. What is driving Sonos' shares and where do they go from here?
Yeah. So this is a company that I think investors view as benefiting from a COVID bump. But the reality is their last fiscal year, revenue growth slowed because 60% or so of their revenue went through retail stores. And as you know, those stores were shut down and they weren't building inventory like they usually do. So initially COVID was a headwind, but what happened is, you know, as you see on the West Coast, we experience on the East Coast, there's been a big housing rotation. You know, people are leaving cities or they're upgrading to larger homes. They're investing in the home they have because they're spending more time there. And, you know, there is a clear correlation on about a 6 month lag of Sonos revenue and housing formation and housing starts. And so they're benefiting from consumers spending more time in the home, not just streaming more music and audio, but also streaming video, because as you may know, they sell home theater speakers, right, that connect to your TV as well. And so there's a, you know, you know, from what I see in the housing market, this isn't slowing down anytime soon, right? You know, if anything, it feels like the momentum is building. And so those are the secular trends that they benefit from. But they also just have become the brand name in streaming music in the home. I think if you go back 3 years ago, there's sort of confusion around voice assistant speakers from the big tech companies versus Sonos, and consumers didn't really understand how to delineate one from the other. And because companies like Amazon and Google were pricing aggressively, that ate into some of Sonos's market. But consumers have realized if they want good quality music in the home, Sonos is the way to go. And they've become really the category killer.
So another one I want to touch on just quickly is Seagate, which I think is an interesting company. Seagate, of course, is just Drive company. They are now, I would point out that there were once literally dozens of disk drive companies. If you go back, and I'm old enough to remember companies like Miniscribe and Micropolis and a bunch of other companies that don't exist anymore. We're really down to two major players, or two and a half. There's only really two public ones you can play, which is Western Digital and Seagate. Western Digital is sort of half of a flash memory play. And so Seagate is really the last pure play on disk drives. It has historically traded at very low multiples of everything. But you're bullish on the stock. Give me a little bit of sense of how you think about Seagate.
Yeah, we think that we think Seagate is in the midst of re-rating. To your point, you know, the stock traded 6 to 8 times PE historically. And that was because they were either losing money or they were earning $6 or $7, and it was quite volatile and very difficult to predict, and just a highly cyclical business. Over the last 4 years, the company has earned, you know, $5, give or take, consistently. And that is because they've invested to move away from products where flash is encroaching on disk, like PCs and gaming and some of the enterprise space, and to invest in cloud data centers and to invest in edge applications like video surveillance, and ultimately autonomous driving will be a big application. But those higher growth, more secular growth categories now make up over half of their business. And so it went from a company that was viewed as a melting sort of ice cube because flash was going to replace disk, as well as a very cyclical business that could never get a
right. And it closely has on the desktop, right?
I mean, yes.
There aren't too many.
But, right, so you have seen in notebooks, as an example, you know, significant penetration of flash. But as that happened, the company invested aggressively in capacity and technology to go after the cloud business and the video business. And they've gotten through that transition and are coming out on the other end with top line growth and, you know, and much higher earnings potential.
Oh my goodness. I set an alarm, which is now going off, but we're going to go a few extra minutes. We have a lot of questions in the chat, and I have one more stock I want to touch on before we get to a couple of the listener questions.
Okay.
One other stock that I know that you like is NCR. Now, NCR, right, of course, is, NCR used to stand for National Cash Register. They make point of sale systems and they make ATMs.
Right.
And you think of them as a reopening play. I'm curious about how you think that plays out. And also, is anyone going to the ATM anymore? Like, what's happening on that side of the business?
Yeah, so this is very much a reopening play on the half of their business that's tied to retail and hospitality, so retail and restaurants. What happened is those customers stayed open, and many of their businesses are doing quite well. Think about fast food, drug stores, grocery stores, mass merchants like
right.
Walmart. Their business is doing well, but they have limitations on the population that can be in their store at any given time. And in many cases, their volumes are higher than pre-COVID. So they haven't wanted to go through a technology upgrade during this period, and they won't until we get vaccine and a, you know, complete pullback in some of the restrictions around how many people can be in their stores at any given time. And so I view this as a pent-up demand story around CapEx spend in retail and restaurants. Those companies are also investing in new technology. So restaurants want to do order online, pick up in store. And NCR has technology to provide to those customers. And in retail, you're moving towards self-checkout. Part of that is because of COVID,
right.
But part of that is because $15 minimum wage. So those machines have 10 times the average selling price as a regular cash register.
Oh, that's interesting.
And better margins. So there's some secular trends, but then there's this cyclical CapEx freeze that is going to thaw over the next couple of quarters if you believe in a reopening. So that's half the business that's retail and restaurants. The other half the business is ATMs. And, you know, I know people are concerned around whether COVID accelerated digital payments. And I think there's certainly some truth to that. But what the banks are doing is they're looking to consolidate branches, but they don't want to abandon their customers. And so they're leaving behind an ATM. And many times an ATM that is more fully configured, where you could do, for instance, a video conversation about your mortgage loan
right.
with somebody sitting in a low-cost region, even if that ATM is in San Francisco or New York City.
So it's not just about getting cash.
Yes. So maybe we have lower levels of cash, but the ATM footprint actually grew last year, and we think will be at least stable going forward. NCR also announced the acquisition of Cardtronics, which basically outsources usage of a fleet of ATMs to banks. So if a bank closes a branch and they don't want to own their own ATM, they can essentially rent the ability for their users to have access to a Cardtronics ATM, maybe sitting in a drugstore or something in their neighborhood. And so I think that was a smart deal. Investors didn't necessarily see it that way right away because they thought, as you said, ATM is maybe not a growth business. Why double down? Right. But this outsourcing angle where they can help banks as they go through branch consolidation is actually a growth area within the ATM space.
Okay. So we're running very short on time. We've gone a little over, and I apologize to the listeners whose questions we're not going to get to. There are at least 3,000 of them on my screen here. So a listener named Adnan has a good question, which I should have gotten to before, which is about iPhone 13 or whatever the next generation of iPhone is going to be. How are you thinking about modeling that in? And, you know, I would note, as I've read a little bit about this, that whereas a year ago, there was tremendous buzz about iPhone 12, there's not a whole lot of buzz right now about iPhone 13 or whatever's going to get launched in September. What are you thinking about there, and how is it impacting your model?
So, I mean, we clearly model iPhone revenue out many years, right? And implicit in that is that every fall there will be a new product launch. And so, yes, you know, we're implicitly modeling iPhone 13. Remember the conversation we had earlier about iPhone replacement cycles? We assume that next year the iPhone replacement rate kind of levels out around 3.7, 3.8 years, which again is above notebook replacements, which, you know, I think is conservative. And so that's the way I think about it more top down. What's a reasonable replacement cycle for a more mature smartphone product category, rather than explicitly saying XYZ function will be in iPhone, whether they call it 12S or 13, and therefore I think it's Y units. As we get into the summer months and into September, we'll get a better read from the supply chain on the builds. But I will tell you that the initial read is that the units are actually up year on year. Some of that is because the launch is going to happen a month earlier, right? So that
September instead of October.
So what will matter is more what the supply chain is saying that the full year looks like, you know, the full cycle looks like year on year. But there are some promising data points already in the supply chain that as we get into the September, December quarters, that there may be unit growth.
And are there particular features you think are going to be in the next gen phone?
Well, you know, I think they teased with the WWDC invite more around augmented reality. And, you know, that is a category that I believe they've been investing in. They've always said that it would happen first on the smartphone, but that eventually they saw a use case for a standalone device. I believe Apple engineers themselves have been using AR, VR devices to communicate with suppliers when they couldn't travel during COVID. And so I imagine the company has realized the use cases are quite broad and maybe there's more a sense of urgency of getting to market with a product like that. But you know, those devices will likely be an accessory to an iPhone, right? And so if you think about what drives that use case, it's really about the camera. I mean, you clearly need CPU and memory upgrades, but you know, the camera really seems to be an area where there's significant differentiation, both the last couple of cycles. But
the iPhone now feels like a camera that has the ability to make calls as opposed to the phone. Take pictures. So we are dramatically over time. I want to thank everyone for listening today. Katie, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
This was fantastic. I'm sure if we kept going, everyone would be staying with us all day, but we probably have a few other things to do today. I want to ask you, everyone, to please join us for Barron's Live tomorrow, when we will have MarketWatch reporter Andrew Keshner speaking with Scott Bishop, who's the executive director of Avidian Wealth Solutions, on how to make the best out of a complicated tax filing season. I still have to do mine. Thanks to all of you for being with us today. Ask everyone to be well, get vaccinated, stay safe. Thanks very much.
Thank you, everyone.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.